eaten clean through in spots. The weapons had been fired just before the plane crashed. The cordite exhaust gas mixing with the moisture in the atmosphere to make carbolic acid that destroyed the weapons slowly. He checked the clips and found them full of lumpy green brass and loose lead rounds. Placing the rapid fire aside, he tried the automatic blasters and found they were in the same condition.
Had to have been one hell of a firefight somewhere.
He studied the sheets of insulation lining the hull and saw no signs of bullet holes. Perhaps the troopers had seized the aircraft by force to escape the nuke storm. Inspecting the collection of uniformed bones, Christie discovered that one of the officers was a woman with a large military cron on her wrist. Christie removed the timepiece and wound the stem to see if it worked. The watch started ticking without pause and continued steadily.
Thank Gaia.
She removed her own wrist cron, smashed in the bus crash, and slid on the new one. It fit fine, and hopefully it was a lot tougher than her old model.
How are the blasters?
Pure junk.
I see something.
Mildred retrieved a briefcase from under the wall seats. A handcuff dangled from its steel handle, but there was no way of knowing which of the dead soldiers it had been attached to. Setting her flashlight on an empty seat, the physician tried to open the case, but it was firmly locked. However, her belt knife swiftly cut through the leather flap holding the carrying case closed. Inside were hundreds of papers bearing government seals, but the printing was so faded with age it was impossible to read in the dim light.
Probably just a duty roster.
Most likely. I'll take these outside and see if I can read them there.
As the woman left, Christie started going through the remnants of the uniforms, and Ryan went to the base of the stairs.
How's it coming, JB?
Almost through.
Stepping out of the forward hold, Dean glanced at the two men working on the door to the cockpit.
How's it coming?
Ryan allowed himself a brief smile. Like father, like son.
Almost through, boy.
Well, I checked the front blasters, see if we could salvage anything. But they're rusted solid, the barrel's full of bird's nests. Lots of 40mm and 20mm ammo shells in the ammo bunkers, but the brass is covered with corrosion.
Mildred walked back in and tossed the briefcase under the seats.
Christie was right. Just a cargo manifest.
Nothing useful, then?
No weapons or food.
Damn.
Got it.
The armored door to the cockpit swung aside. There was another rush of stale air. After it passed, Ryan and JB stepped into the cockpit, their faces tense with anticipation. The sunlight streamed in through the leafy-edged windows, casting odd shadows. The remains of the command crew were in the same positions, but now their clothing was starting to visibly decompose at the invasion of clean air. Ryan gave the skeletons a fast glance, while JB took out his compass and went to the dashboard. He flipped several switches until the needle stopped jerking.
It was their emergency beacon. The nuke batteries were almost drained. Another couple of months, and we never would have found this plane.
Lying on the deck, Ryan was looking under the pilot's chair.
Seals are unbroken.
JB found himself doing the same under the co-pilot's chair.
Same here. We might just be in luck here.
Both men got busy with their knives, removing service panels, and then slicing through the nest of wiring inside the seats. They knew the sequence, blue, green, red, and each man did the job carefully. Ejector seats were tricky. Ryan remembered when Finn tried to take one apart too fast, and it launched straight through the top of the plane, damn near taking his head along with it for a ride.
What?
Nothing.
Soon they had the ejector rockets disassembled and toppled the seats to extract sturdy plastic boxes shaped like lopsided arches. They were sealed airtight, but JB made short work of the locks. Lining the inside was some form of clear plastic wrapping that knives wouldn't cut. But Ryan found a ring tab on the side and gently pulled it along the seam, the plastic parting sluggishly to expose a layer of gray foam. Tossing away the plastic, the one-eyed warrior removed the cushion to finally uncover an assortment of supplies, each neatly nestled in a shaped depression in the foam. It was the wealth of the pre-dark world, in perfect condition.
Good stuff?
The best, son.
This is a pilot survival kit. An emergency pack for a crashed pilot to grab as he ran from a burning plane. Just enough supplies to keep him alive for a few weeks until a rescue team could arrive.
Haven't seen one in years. They're almost always taken after the crash.
Not this time.
JB freed the co-pilot's survival kit and then started defusing the navigator's chair. Soon the five seats were in pieces and the precious kits splayed open. There were 5 9mm Heckler & Koch blasters, vials of oil, 15 empty clips, 10 boxes of ammo. Survival knives with whetstones, fishing line and hooks, dye markers, Very pistols with colored flares, signal mirrors, water purification tabs, gold coins, MRE packs, spools of wire, bundles of rope, and med kits.
Mildred, got something for you.
Be right there.
The physician eagerly went through the collection of pills and capsules, throwing away most of the drugs. Even sealed in an airtight container, a lot of the chemicals would have lost their potency over the long decades, and a few would have turned lethal. Everything else she placed in her battered shoulder bag. Bandages, bug repellent sticks, elastic bandages, methamphetamines, barbiturates, sulfur powder, antiseptic cream, as hard as a rock but reclaimable, sunscreen, toothpaste, 3 hypodermic needles, sutures, surgical thread, iodine tablets, and silver-based antibiotics. After taking inventory, the companions divided the supplies, each taking what he or she needed the most. Ryan and JB split the 9mm ammo, the Uzi getting the lion's share. Ryan, Christy, and Mildred each took one of the fancy two-tone H&K blasters to replace their depleted weapons. Neither woman cared for auto fires. The things had a bad tendency to jam just when you needed them most. However, 15 shots of maybe was better than 2 rounds of definite. Since the Browning had a full clip, Dean took the Very pistol and studied the single-shot blaster until figuring out how the 30mm breechloader worked. The catch was very simple. Satisfied, he tucked it away and filled his pockets with the flares. The stubby gun could throw a flare 300 feet into the air, where it would detonate into brilliant colors to help searchers find a lost crew member. But the device could also fire horizontally and punch a sizzling flare through a man at 50 feet. Nodding her approval, Christy took the other Very and the rest of the signal flares.
Be right back. I'm going to wrap Jack again. This'll get him back on his feet.
Good. Give him this pistol, too. No spare ammo, but it's something.
Right. See ya.
Here's your share, Doc.
JB placed a pile of food packs, soap, razor blades, and other assorted small items next to the man sitting on the ramp. Amid the salvage was the last of the H&K pistols.
Thank you.
Doc reluctantly lifted the blaster. The Lamar was on its last reload. 9 shots and he was defenseless. Awkwardly, the man worked the slide of the blaster, chambering around, and experimented dropping the clip, then reinserting it. Then, weighing the weapon in his palm, he clicked on the safety to tuck the blaster away in his frock coat.
Great news.
What, Mildred? Jack can walk now? Good.
Better than that. Remember those cargo manifests I was just looking at? Well, I couldn't read them at all until Jack smeared the paper with gun oil. Damned if that didn't bring the words out nice and clear. What were they carrying? Hovercrafts? Weather sensing equipment? Balloons to carry computerized pods high into the sky to check on the pollution levels from the old nukes, I guess. To see if the air was any better.
Stop using the damn nukes. Then the air would get better.
Amen, lad.
Weather balloons. Big ones?
30 feet across.
How many?
Hundreds. A year's supply, at least. Don't know the lift-to-drag ratio, so we just make it as large as possible. Always best to err on the side of power.
We need something for a basket.
Ryan nudged the shipping pallet with his boot. The honeycomb plastic was a good foot thick and more than 10 feet wide on each side. Designed to airdrop supplies to troops in the field, the pallets would make perfect bottoms.
Yeah, these should work fine. They're light and very strong. Just no sides.
We can tie extra ropes around the support ropes. Weave a basket around the pallet. And we could use the ropes lashing down the canvas to hold it all together. The cargo netting's plastic and should certainly be strong enough.
You folks firing blanks? We're gonna fly to Forbidden Island?
Standing, Doc wet a finger and held it outside.
The wind is blowing in the correct direction. Well done, madam. An exemplary idea. There is no way Mitchum could follow us aloft.
Fly the Hercules? Hot pipe! This thing'll never eat clouds again. It's completely aced.
We're not going to use the plane, Dean. We'll fly the cargo.
Worked once before. Why not again?
How can we steer?
We'll wet blankets and hold them over the side. That'll give us some drag. If we hold them out over the left, that'll slow us down and we'll drift to the left.
Crude and dangerous. Like our boy Jack. Yet, alas, we don't really have another choice.
Anybody want to row across 50 miles of open sea with those steam-powered PT boats hunting for us all the way? Didn't think so. Okay, we start with the ropes.
Hot pipe.
Dean was surprised how easily the craft was constructed. The sun was hovering just above the horizon by the time the balloon was ready to launch. The cargo netting barely proved adequate to contain the weather balloons, as they were filled